Good afternoon. So last time we talked about user versus kernel modes. We said our processor is going to permit the OS to do things like enforce permissions by making it so the OS runs with extra access to the hardware. And the way we implemented this is we added this sort of one bit of information that the hardware would track about whether the current code was running in kernel mode. And if it was, its instructions could do more operations. Otherwise, you were limited to a more restricted set of instructions. But there was a problem here that, well, we want to run all your programs with this more restricted set, but we want to let them do some things that that restricted set doesn't include, some things the OS wants to allow kind of selectively. And rather than trying to communicate with the hardware about here are the things I want to allow, we instead kind of have this escape hatch where we can run something in the OS on our behalf, and the OS code can analyze whether it's okay to allow the requested operation or not. And that hatch was called a system call. And to help us implement this as an operating system author, the hardware is going to provide us with this special instruction on 64-bit x86 Linux. That instruction is called syscall. And what that instruction does is it invokes a handler that the OS set up as we boot the machine. That handler is the only thing which handles the system call requests. And it can't, its location can't be changed by the program, so the OS can make sure the program only does acceptable things with its request by just restricting what things that handler will do. We also mentioned, well, you need to make system calls from your programs in order to access OS functionality. How does that work? And we have these things which often are documented as system calls, which are functions you can call in the standard library. And we learned, well, those aren't really system calls, because when you write foo with parentheses, that's a call instruction, not a syscall instruction. But we really wanted to provide this convenient interface for C programmers to access this functionality, so we implemented these system call wrappers. We have these functions whose only purpose is to set things up for a system call. We saw an example in the slides of open. So there's an open operation that opens a file, checks its permissions and all that stuff, but asks the OS to open a file for your program. We can call an open function from C, and that function is a little library function that just sets up the registers for the system call handler and runs the syscall instruction. It doesn't do any of the real work of opening the file. It just forwards the request on to that kernel code that can actually access this special functionality used to do that. Okay. So then we moved on to looking at an example of memory protection, which is where we're going to continue this time. And in that example of memory protection, we were looking at, you know, if we have a program, can we access something, you know, some memory location, can it be changed by another program? The answer we found out was no, and we'll look into more about what, why that is and how that works in a sec. Before I move on to that, questions about sort of user mode and kernel mode and system calls? Okay. So last time we finished up with this example here. We have this program here where these move instructions are moving, are basically taking memory at 0x10000 and sending it into RAX. And we had this instruction in a different program that was trying to, seems like, write the same memory location. And we asked first the question of, well, in program A, what is the final value of RAX going to be? When we read from that memory location that we started the process with having the value 42, is that 99 from program B going to end up in there? And the answer with the OS as we are used to is never. It just was not going to ever be there. And then there's a question of what happens in program B. And the sort of the key reason why the answer is never is that we have these mappings. So, and these mappings for the address space. So when program A is accessing 0x1000, that's going to go through this mapping the OS configured before running the program. And presumably, that's going to go somewhere in this program A's data region. And when program B does the same operation, that's presumably either going to go somewhere else, because there's no program B, just doesn't have anything that points to the same region of program A. And there's kind of two possibilities for what happens in program B. So one option is there's no mapping. So we have program B is going to crash. It's going to segfault. Another option is there is a mapping, but it's not going to be the same as program A. It's like maybe it maps to somewhere in here, or somewhere else, but it's not going to map to the same place as program A's, sort of private terminal. And one thing that I have this slide for to talk about with these mappings is that usually the mappings are primarily set up so the two programs are independent of each other. But if we don't want to do that, we don't have to. So we'll do kind of deliberate sharing. And that's kind of a big advantage of this technique, is that we don't have to have program A and program B be completely separate. We can have them be sort of share stuff in a controlled manner. And probably the most common case you'll see this is with dynamically linked libraries. So we'd like to load only one copy of libc. So we talked about only having one copy of libc on disk, like only one implementation of printf. We can do better than that. We can only have one implementation of printf in memory, even though we have like 20 programs running that all use printf. And the way we can do that is by setting it up so they all share the memory that contains the machine code for printf. And because the OS controls this mapping, the OS can make the mapping point to the same place when it wants to, make it not when it doesn't want to. And so, for example, we can just put the printf implementation in that shared area. So questions about this mapping here? And we mentioned at the beginning of the class that this mapping is called virtual memory. And something I want you to think that we'll get back to a little later is that this kind of looks like a fake machine, that as far as program A and program B are concerned, they're running on a machine that has memory at these particular locations, and that's all they know. And as we'll talk about later, it's going to turn out they're going to think they're running on a machine that has like particular cores with particular register values, even though that's not how it's going to be implemented. We're going to implement it by sharing potentially fewer actual physical sets of registers. So questions about our memory address space mapping? Okay, so one thing I mentioned is that maybe when program B looks up 0x10000, there's no mapping, and it's going to crash. What does crashing look like? What is the hardware actually doing in that case, right? We might have a crash. What happens? And on systems we're used to, some other program is going to be informed about the crash. And that program usually will display a message about it. Doesn't have to. But there's a question of what does the hardware do? The hardware doesn't actually know how to contact the break program and like print a message to whatever terminal or SSH session you're using about the crash, like you're used to like seeing segmentation fault. So it needs the OS's help to handle this situation. And we need some way where the hardware is going to run some OS routine to say, hey, this program accessed some memory that you didn't set up a mapping for. Handle it, please. And that's what's going to happen. And we need, therefore, some way for the hardware to basically call a function in the OS. And fortunately, we already have a mechanism like that. We had system calls. So we're going to generalize the system call mechanism to include more than just system calls, but other reasons the hardware would invoke the OS. But it's going to be the same idea that the hardware is going to look for a location the OS set up at boot. It's going to invoke a function the OS pointed to, and that function does whatever the OS wants to do. In the case of a segfault, it's going to say, okay, this memory was not valid. Let's inform the program, the shell that ran it, hey, your program crashed, and get rid of the excess resources of the program so we don't run out of space on the system. And we'll call this generalization of system calls exceptions. So we're going to use the term exceptions. If I want to disambiguate between these exceptions and the ones you know about in Java, I'll use the term hardware exceptions, but we'll probably just use the term exception in this class. And I mean this way for the hardware to run the OS. I do not mean Java exceptions. And basically, the exception is a mechanism for the hardware to ask the OS for help. It doesn't know how to do it itself. It needs the OS to help it out. And it's going to use the same idea as system calls, that we're going to switch to kernel mode and run a function the OS told us about earlier. But we're not just going to do it because a program asked for help. We're going to do it because the hardware has some other situation it needs to handle. And we're going to end up with actually a whole bunch of different situations that the hardware is going to handle with exceptions. So we have our system calls, which are exceptions triggered by a program deliberately asking for the OS's help. And we mentioned this idea that if a program accesses memory it's not supposed to, the thing you know as a segmentation fault, well, that happened because it triggered the OS's help. Hey, what do you want to do about this program that's accessing memory it's not supposed to? We'll also use this to handle other weird things a program might do. So for example, if a program tries to access some instruction that only works in kernel mode, and it's not in kernel mode, the processor is going to ask the OS, hey, what do you want to do about this program that was like trying to access the disk directly? And probably the OS will crash the program just like a segfault. Similar for like a divide by zero or a malformed machine code and things like that. So questions about our list of types of exceptions so far? So something we're missing in this list that's kind of hinted at here is that so far, all the exceptions I'm talking about are things where the processor is trying to run the current program and it can't proceed on its own for some reason. Either because the program did something like basically broken, or the program explicitly asked for it to be stopped and the OS to run. But we're going to see that there's going to be a reason we want to have other types of exceptions that are not triggered by the code we were actually running. So I'm going to call the ones that are triggered by the code we're running synchronous. And there's going to be a reason I said we want to do, other types. And kind of the easiest motivation for that is, keeping programs from hanging the system. So if I write while one and run this program on portal, like it shouldn't hang an entire core in portal. If I run as many copies of this program as there are cores on portal, you should still be able to use portal. And if we don't have some sort of other way for the OS to run, that won't happen, right? Once the OS starts running this program, there's no error in these instructions. If we think of the assembly, like this is going to be loop, jump, loop. That's the assembly. There's nothing, no memory access that's out of bounds there. There's no divide by zero. There's no reason for the processor to just stop running that. But the OS is going to want there to be a reason. So we're going to want to have cases where the OS gets to run even though the current program didn't do anything that demands that itself. And so we'll have exceptions triggered by what I'll call external events. And the type that's going to stop our infinite while loop idea is going to be what we'll call timer, a timer interrupt usually. So an exception triggered by a timer. So there's usually going to be a timer that the OS can set up like an alarm clock before it runs your program. And when that alarm clock goes off, the processor runs the OS handler for the timer going off. And conceptually, I call this external. Like it's probably actually on the physical processor, but it kind of acts like something external to the processor. And we're going to use the same mechanism to handle things that are actually external to the processor, like a key press. Like if you press Control C, you hope the OS gets to run real soon to stop whatever's happening. And we're in fact going to make that happen because generally input and output are going to trigger exceptions. The processor is going to recognize that input and output is happening, something that needs attention, and it's going to run the OS to handle that input and output. And that will happen regardless of whether your current program cares about it. Because, you know, what program's running when I press a key on the keyboard doesn't affect whether I press the key on the keyboard. The OS needs to deal with the key being pressed on the keyboard regardless. So we'll have these external events triggered by all sorts of I/O devices. You know, whenever input or output needs attention from the computer, the hardware generally won't know how to deal with that itself. Like it doesn't know where key presses should go. It doesn't know if I'm reading from a disk, where should the data that was just read go? And all that stuff. So the hardware needs to ask for the OS's help to handle these input and output events. And because those are not triggered by what the program was necessarily doing, they'll happen even if the program's running our silly infinite loop. So questions about our last type of exceptions here? Last kind of reason we can trigger exceptions. And I would like to emphasize that all of these are exceptions. System calls are a specific example of this category. But we have our, you know, what our reading calls interrupts, which are these external events. And we have these sort of things that go wrong in programs, which our reading calls faults. Those are all types of exceptions. I'm mentioning this because people often say, oh, it's a system call. No, system call's more specific. But since they're all using the same mechanism, so we're going to have this familiar generalized diagram that looks very much like our system call diagram for what happens on an exception. First, the hardware somehow detects the exception. And we learned that it's not just going to be a syscall instruction. That's one thing the hardware could detect. It could also detect the program accessing a memory address it's not supposed to, or dividing by zero. Or it could detect that you pressed a key. Whatever the hardware detects, it's something worthy of the OS's attention, and it's going to get the OS's attention by switching to kernel mode and running what we'll call the exception handler, that code the OS set up at boot to handle this type of event. And usually the OS gets to set up separate handlers for each kind of exception. So there'll be one handler for system calls, one handler for key presses, one handler for timers, and so on. But they all run the same way. It's just jump to a location the OS set up earlier. So then the OS handles it however it wants to. Maybe it handles it by killing the program. Maybe it handles it by just taking some input and putting it away for later. But it handles it however it needs to, and then when it's done handling it, it goes back to user mode. And it may be in the simplest case, it just goes back to the same program that it was in the middle of, but it doesn't have to. It can switch to a different program. And that switching to a different program is really useful for like our infinite loop case. Questions? And so at the beginning of the semester, we talked about time multiplexing, and that was this idea that we have sort of multiple programs, if we're thinking of our axis of being time, share the processor's time by switching off between them. And in between each of those programs, we're going to run the OS for a little bit. And that's precisely going to be this exception process, that there's going to be some sort of exception. Could be a system call, could be a key press, but some sort of event triggers an exception. The OS handler runs for a little bit, and then when it returns, it doesn't have to return back to the same program. It can, but it doesn't have to. And that's how it can share the processor between multiple programs. You have a question?
Are these like little operating system breaks, are they scheduled or are they triggered into something constant for an exception?
So question, are these operating system breaks scheduled or are they triggered? So we have all these reasons the operating system gets to run. And if the operating system wants to, it can write code to context switch on any of these events. One of these is scheduled, right? This timer is scheduled by the OS. So that would indeed be scheduled. The other ones aren't. And it's up to the OS when it decides to switch. And there, if you take a more advanced OS class, you'll learn that there's lots of trade-offs in deciding, do I want to switch more often or less often? If I press a key, do I immediately switch to the program that wants to read that key press? There's trade-offs there. So OSs make different decisions for that in practice. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So we know about this idea of switching. Let's talk about sort of what's going on when the OS returns back to a different program. How does that happen? And kind of our process is the OS starts running, and when it starts running, it's going to save what the program it started running in the middle of was doing. And it's going to save its registers and the program counter, and also the address mapping, that mapping from program addresses to real addresses. We're going to stash that away somewhere for later. And then if we decide we want to switch to a different program, before we return back to user mode, instead of restoring the stuff we just saved, we'll restore some other version of that. Maybe something we saved earlier. Something for a different program, a different program's registers and program counter and address mapping. And this process is known as a context switch. So if it's a context switch, what's the context? The context is this information we save. So we're saving one information for one program, one context, and restoring another context when we do a context switch. And that other context we restore is probably one we saved earlier. And that's how we pause a program for a while and go back to it. When we pause it, we save its context, restore some unrelated program's context. When we go back to it, we restore the original program's context. So questions about this idea of a context? Yeah?
This is more about the previous slide.
So the question is, what in the hardware is actually listening for input-output in the keyboard? So I guess there are probably multiple ways of implementing this hardware, but kind of the, I think the simplest way of looking at it is you can imagine maybe there's a special register in the hardware, and the implementation of every instruction has this extra step of check that register, and if it's set, do a funny jump instead of running the instruction as usual. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
What is the program counter?
What is the program counter? The program counter is the term for the address of the next instruction to run. You might also know this as the instruction pointer. Some textbooks use that term. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. So the question, what happens to the stack in all of this? So the address mapping tells us, if we know an address on the stack, where it actually is stored in memory. And the other part of the stack is, like the old registers, are going to have the stack pointer. So we don't copy any of the main memory of the program because we have this address mapping idea. That's a big optimization, because you could imagine a much less efficient way of doing this is we could like copy all the memory to disk, load the other program from disk, start running it, and then, you know, when we want to go back, read everything back from disk. But we don't do that. Instead, we keep it in memory. We just have it in memory at different locations than the other program. And our address mapping lets us do that very freely. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Question, for context switches, when it jumps back to user mode, does it always go back to a different program? We don't call it a context switch if it goes back to the same program. We'll only call it a context switch if we're restoring a different context than the one we just saved. If we're restoring the same one we just saved, basically we're just doing, you know, a function call where we save stuff we didn't need to save. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah?
The kernel kind of runs its own process though, right? So isn't that kind of like, it needs to save the context of the current program and then run the kernel code and then go back?
Question, the kernel kind of runs its own process, or it needs to save the context of the current program and then go back? So if we aren't switching to another program, we indeed need to save things and then go back. I won't call that a context switch because we're not changing context. We're keeping the same context at before and after. This might be a fuzzy with some OS designs, because you could design an OS where like you kind of internally do a funny context switch, but usually that's not what happens. And like the way I distinguish it is that if it looks like what we do on a normal function call, that's not a context switch, right? And what you're talking about in the normal case is kind of like a normal function call. Maybe we're just saving a few more registers than we would normally, but it's basically what we do in a function call. What's different with a context switch is that like there's not this sort of perfect symmetry between what we save and what we restore, and that's very deliberate. That answer your question? Yeah. So if I need to go to a new program, why am I saving information about a previous program? So my assumption is if the program isn't crashing, the original program, I'm going to go back to it later. And this answers the question of where did this come from? And the answer is we saved it earlier as part of this process. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so I have kind of a pictorial view that might be clear or might not. So that we can think of, we have two processes running, and when process A is actually active, its sort of context information is on the processor. So here that represents the actual processor has, you know, one processor core has all its registers, its program counter, its flags, all that information is there. We've set up the memory mapping, so all its pointers in there point to its actual memory region. And process B isn't active right now, but because it isn't active and we need to go back to it, we have a copy of everything it used to have on the processor lying around in the OS's memory. We saved that earlier when we started running A, or maybe when we started running some other program. We saved it earlier. And that means at some point we can decide that process A has had enough time, and we'll switch to process B, and we'll just put all of processes A's stuff in our memory and copy all the stuff that used to be in our memory to the CPU. So questions? Got our context switch idea. Yes? Where does it store the previous, what?
Like what is the point of it stores the previous program? Since you're switching from A to B, and then you can store A or something, where does it store A?
Question, where does it store A? So in between, you know, A running and B running, the OS runs, and it's gonna run instructions sort of as part of the switch, where it's going to like move RAX to some memory location and then restore some other memory location into RAX. And it's going to do that for everything it's saving, so it's a little more complicated for the flags and the program counter. Basically, we're running, just copying stuff into a memory location and then restoring it from a different one, copying it back into those registers. And there's a little bit of an exception with how we deal with the program counter. And for that, we're gonna have a little help from the hardware. The hardware is gonna save for us somewhere the program counter that the program had before we started running. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions?
So if you had like 9 processes going, would you have 8 of them stored and 1 of them?
Question, if I had 9 processes going, would I have 8 of them stored? Yeah, so I'd have this 8, assuming I had 1 core. Yeah. This is assuming a 1 core processor. We had multiple cores, we'll have multiple instances of in CPU at the same time. Yeah. How does the OS know how much memory to allocate? So you mean for each process or for the saved context?
For like the same context, like if I had like 10 different processes and I just kept adding processes, is it just adding memory to store this stuff in the OS as we're going, or is it?
So the question is, how does it allocate memory for the specific context? And the context is usually pretty small, because it's just the registers, and we're gonna learn that the address mapping is basically represented with a pointer. So that is actually pretty small, but indeed we need to allocate space in some OS memory, and that might be dynamically allocated, it might be sort of fixed size, but the storage of the context on a modern sort of desktop or laptop-y size system like probably doesn't become an issue until we're getting into the millions of threads, which are the CPU part of processes. So we have millions of these on a modern system. And other things will become an issue before that. As for the program's memory, our mapping lets us allocate it piecemeal. So if a program, even if a program is using addresses all over the place, we can only allocate the parts that it actually needs. And therefore, you know, how many processes we can have the data and code stored for is just a question of how much data and code do they need. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
This may be too big of a question, but like, how would you possibly decide how much CPU time one process needs?
Question, how would you possibly decide how much CPU time one process needs? This is a, if you take operating systems, this probably will be a topic there, usually is. And like, the short answer is you try running it and see if it needs to keep running. And the real interesting questions are like, if I have two different things I can run, which one do I choose? Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so what context switch give us is something we'll call a thread. And a thread kind of gives us the illusion of our own processor. And why is it the illusion of our own processor? Because we have, it seems, our own copy of the resources that are on the CPU. We have our own register values, our own program counter values, you know, that are independent for this thread, the thing that we switch between with a context switch. And we implement this by having many threads share one processor. And I should skip ahead to, yeah. We'll call the combination of one or more threads and the address mapping idea a process. So a process is going to have these threads that are kind of a virtual CPU. They have their own registers, their own program counter. They, you know, they can jump around your machine code independently. You might have more than one. We'll talk about how you program with more than one thread later in the semester. And we also have this address space, which is kind of this notion of your memory. And this kind of gives us this process, which you can think of as a sort of type of virtual machine. It looks like you have a machine with its own processors and its own memory, even though we know that's actually implemented by sharing it with other programs, sharing both the processors and the memory with other programs. So questions on what a process is. Okay, so in that case, let's talk about some things we kind of skipped over with exceptions. And the big one is we talked about I/O devices involving exceptions, but we didn't really talk about how that works. And this is maybe not completely intuitive because we know that dealing with I/O devices involves both system calls and exceptions, right? When you want to write to a file on disk, you need the OS's help, so use a system call. But it also involves these externally triggered exceptions when the disk is communicating with the operating system about, does it have data ready? Is it ready to write? So let's talk about sort of the typical pattern that happens when we want to do input or output, which is usually going to involve multiple different exceptions, a combination of system calls and these externally triggered exceptions. And I'll start with the most complicated case, which is with input. And there's kind of two things which can happen when you write a program that reads input, like input from a keyboard, input from a disk. One case that can happen is you request input, like the key presses, and you're lucky because those have already been received by the OS. So what would happen in that case is that some point when I pressed a key, the HART keyboard device signaled to the processor that it had input, and the processor said, oh, I better run the OS to handle that. And the OS got to run through this externally triggered exception, and it just stashed that key press somewhere for later. It didn't know what to do with it yet because I didn't even request the key press yet. I just pressed a key and no program had read the keyboard input yet. It was just typing ahead of it. And that's fine. And later on, I'm gonna ask the OS, hey, OS, give me the key press. And what the OS is gonna do is gonna say, oh, earlier I saved that somewhere. Let me give you a copy of that, here you go. And that's the kind of simplest way it can handle your request for input, is that it already stashed it earlier. Why did it run earlier to stash it? Because the hardware sent it a signal, you know, when the input was available for it to handle. The slightly more complicated case is, let's say I run my program and I let it run a little bit before I start typing, so it's already asked for keyboard input before I typed anything. That also works, as we know. You know, you run a program, just waits for input. So what happened is that that program, it told the OS, hey, I'd like to get some input, and the OS looked at whether it had stashed that input earlier, and the answer was no, it hadn't. It didn't have any input ready. Yeah, so it needed to wait. So what it does is it just says, just record somewhere that, hey, I need some keyboard input for this program. Or if you were like asking to read from the disk, it would like set up, let's get some stuff from the disk later. But it wouldn't wait right away. It would just do something useful. And something useful is probably not checking, is there keyboard input now? Is there keyboard input now? Is there keyboard input now? It's going to do something else if there's anything to do. And so probably it would context switch away from your program. And sometime later, my keyboard or maybe my hard drive is going to signal the processor, hey, now I have that input you were waiting for, or might have been waiting for. The OS is going to handle that, and it's going to look up. Huh, there's this input. Who's interested in it? Oh, this program asked me earlier. I better tell it about that. And it will retrieve that input and get it ready to send back to the program. And at this point, the OS actually has a choice. So the most straightforward thing would be, oh, if you ask to read from the keyboard and I get keyboard input, you should, when it happens, run the program right away. That's kind of the most straightforward thing you could imagine an OS doing. That's not always what the operating system will do. Sometimes the operating system will decide, well, I just started this other program. I don't want to switch away from it right away. So it will just stash the input for later, and then when it has a chance where it feels like, you know, its policy says basically that it's a good time to run the original program, it will do that. So questions about this sort of these typical patterns with programs requesting input and how the OS, you know, gets informed about the input from the hardware. Like the key thing, yes, sorry.
So when the program says that it wants to read input, is that, and then the OS saves that, is that like a, it's just like, it's like a state that it saves in memory, or is it just like run that all over and over again until it gets input?
So the question is, when the program makes this I want to read input request, how does the OS track that information? And the most common thing is that I want to read input operation is like you did a scanf, which did a read system call. And the read system call doesn't return until later. So system call start, and then the read system call return. So basically, your system call will be pending. It won't go back to you until that's done. That's the most common way. It's also not possible for OSs to provide interfaces which maybe are arguably more flexible, where you just say, I'm interested in this input later, and I'll request it later on my own time or something like that. But most typically, you're going to make something like a read call, which like what scanf turns into or getline turns into, and that's just going to wait. And when we're waiting, the OS is just not going to run you until it's ready. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. What if there are two programs that ask for the input at the same time? So the OS is responsible for having a decision about who gets it. And that's entirely up to whoever programmed the OS how that works. Like probably most commonly, we'll designate one program at a time, that receives keyboard input would be the simplest thing, but it's not the only strategy. And we'll just say if a different program requests keyboard input, it doesn't get it until it's the one getting the program keyboard input. Would be a simple way of handling it, but there are other options too. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so this is the pattern with input, and we have something similar happening with output. That you make a call saying, I want to output this. So we saw that there's a write system call that does this, which is kind of what printf usually turns into. Saying, I want to output something. And sometimes the output device will be ready right away. In which case the OS just handles outputting that and finishes the system call. In other cases, you want to output something and the OS figures out, oh, the device doesn't accept output right now. So an example where this would be pretty common to happen would like be with Wi-Fi. You can't always send immediately on the Wi-Fi. You might need to wait for other things to be sent first and things like that. So it will just say, I can't output right away. I'll just remember this and deal with it later. And when is later going to be? Well, probably the device is going to use an exception to run the OS and tell it, this device is ready for output. When the OS runs in response to that, it looks up, here's the output I had saved earlier. Let me actually send that to the device now. Questions about examples of output with exceptions? And thinking of our read example, so here's like the typical timeline for reading input. That's right, that I have my program that reads, it makes this system call, and that system call basically just records that you're interested in future, in this example, key presses. And the OS runs other things because it knows you aren't interested in running based on that read system call until you get a key press. So it runs some other things for a while until the keyboard input happens. And in this example, it decides right away to switch back to your program when that happens, to presumably because you've been waiting a while. So questions? Let's read timeline. Okay, so one minor point about, definition review before we do a little exercise. So the exception is that the hardware runs an OS routine, and a context switch is switched to another thread that's that virtual processor, sort of own set of registers and program counter. And the context switch is something the OS can do when it's handling an exception. It isn't a type of exception. It's just one of the actions the OS can take when it runs. And when does the OS run? When there's an exception. Let's do a little exercise. You have a bunch of things here that happen in your programs probably. Which of them require exceptions to occur, and which of them require context switches to occur? You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree with which. We'd like some more time? Okay, a few people. Okay, let's start with which require exceptions. So who thinks A requires an exception, at least one exception to occur? Okay, a few people. B. Okay, C. Okay, D. E. F. Okay, so let's start with exceptions. So we have pretty good consensus that B requires an exception and C less consensus about the other ones. I have some prepared slides for this. So for A, it does not. And this is one trick people up because some standard library functions make system calls. Some very much don't. So like stringlang, pow, there's nothing that requires special access to the processor. We don't need help from the OS to do those operations. So there's actually a whole bunch of standard library calls that never trigger an exception in normal operation. So we absolutely don't require one. It's true that making a standard library call can indirectly trigger an exception, but it's definitely not required, and often you make one and don't do that. The other nitpicky thing you could say is that if you think of calling the standard library function as just the call instruction, that never really requires an exception, but maybe that's being a little too obtuse. Then we have writing the file to disk. And we can determine this needs an exception because we need the OS's help somewhere. Right. We can't talk to IO devices directly. Only the OS is allowed to do that itself. So an exception had to have happened to run the OS code that's allowed to talk to disks directly. You know, if that wasn't the case, then there's a question of what about permissions for the file? How is that enforced? Would it have a way? So then C, for a program going to sleep and letting another program run, the answer is yes, that's going to require an exception. And the way we can conclude that is that you can't access another program's stuff normally. So you need the OS's help to start running another program. And in fact, typically the go to sleep operation is going to be a system call where you say, hey OS, I'd like help not running my program anymore. Can you help me out with that? And the OS will probably help you out by running some other program. So questions about our first three things that do and don't require exceptions? Okay, so then our last few. So the program exiting does need an exception to happen. And this is for the same reason as C, that we needed to change sort of settings that are restricted to the OS to start running a different program, and that's part of exiting. So somehow the OS had to start running. That must have happened with an exception. That's the only way we can run the OS in kernel mode to do this for us. And probably it was a system call. We learned that there's an exit system call. But even if our program exited by crashing, same idea. That there's an exception that triggered that crash that let the OS run in order to switch away from our program. Then we have returning from one function to another and popping a value from the stack. These do not require exceptions. These are things that are part of the things the processor lets us do entirely in user mode. We don't need any help. We don't ordinarily expect any the OS to be involved in these operations. So questions about any of these things and why are they do or do not need exceptions to happen? Yeah?
Which ones would be context switches?
Which ones would be context switches? I have a slide for that. And the answer is C and D would be context switches because we're switching from one process to another. The other ones, maybe we do end up switching in the middle of them. We don't need to. Does that answer your question? Yeah? Question, what if we don't have another program? So usually if there's nothing to run in the system, the operating system will supply a thread to run. Usually the thread it supplies to run will try to put the processor into the lowest power mode it can and run an infinite loop. Does that answer your question?
So
it will run something, yes. It will probably, and it will try to put the processor in like the lowest power mode it can, but if we aren't shutting down the system, the processor is still active and trying to run instructions at some point.
Okay.
Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, are all context switches exceptions? Let's go back to our definition. So, context switches are a thing the OS does when it runs. The OS runs from an exception, also at boot. But context switch is just a thing the OS can do. They're not the same thing. So when we say that these events here involve a context switch, that context switch isn't the system call. That was the exception. It's just something the system call handler did.
Okay.
Just like the system call handler could print a message to the screen, one of the things it has the option of doing is a context switch.
Okay. Then I guess just as a follow-up question, then are all context switches caused by exceptions?
Question, are all context switches caused by exceptions? Because they have, because the switching, if they're switching between different programs, we have to have
the OS's help. Yes, they're all something that happens after an exception. I'm avoiding the word caused by because that cause might be kind of indirect. Because it's whatever the OS's logic for whether the context switch might not be, was there an exception, it might be some other thing it's looking at. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you first boot up the laptop, you wanted to do before, and it runs like class code, and then executes its first program, would that also be considered as a context switch?
Question, when we first boot up a machine and run the first program, is that considered the context switch? We will avoid answering that question. I would say usually it's implemented with the same code. Other questions? Okay, so one last thing let's talk about is terminology. So terms for exceptions are very non-standardized, unfortunately. So our readings call the externally triggered exceptions interrupts, call the ones triggered by events in a program faults, call the eventually triggered things traps, system calls being a type of trap in this taxonomy. We're not gonna test you on these specific terms. We do care that you know what an exception, system call, and context switch are. We don't care about interrupt and fault and trap, and the big reason why is that everyone is inconsistent about these terms. Some people, the term exception and all of these terms, like they're all have different definitions depending who you're talking to, both different textbooks, different processor manuals. So in the real world, you have to look for context to know when they write interrupt, what do they really mean? It might be different. Okay, so in our last 10 minutes or so, we're gonna talk about a feature with processes. So we mentioned processes are kind of these dead, sort of fake machines, like it kind of looks like you have a machine to yourself. And on Unix-like operating systems, they provide a feature that you can kind of think of as giving you something like exceptions in your fake machine. And this is called signals. And like our hardware exceptions, these signals can be triggered by external events, like another process asking the OS to trigger a signal, or I/O. And like hardware exceptions, when they happen, one thing that can happen is that they run a signal handler in the machine. In this case, we'll run a signal handler as a function in your process. We're not running an OS function because this is your process. This is a user application mechanism. And so they're kind of, as I said, analogous. So, like, to get different. So our hardware exceptions, like, we run this exception handler in kernel mode. With these signals, the handler is running in your thread. It runs in user mode, just like your normal functions. It doesn't actually have extra access. With hardware exceptions, the hardware is the one responsible for deciding now it's time to run the handler. With signals, the OS is making that decision. Basically, the OS, instead of just switching to your program normally, it will switch to your program and make a function call in it. And in hardware exceptions, the hardware is going to help us out by saving the program counter. The OS will save the rest. In signal handlers, our signal handler will look like a normal function call, which means the OS is handling saving registers following the calling convention for us. And because this is in our virtual sort of process, when a signal handler runs, it stops whatever our thread was doing that we were running and runs that function, that handler we specified as part of our program. Just as if our program had made that function call to that handler in the middle of whatever it was doing. And I'll go through an example which will hopefully make this a little clearer. So I'm going to start with a program here that just reads lines of input and prints out red that line of input. So if I run it, I can type in some input. It's going to output red some input. Type in some input. It's going to output red some input. And I forgot to give me a way of terminating this program, so I'll type Control C, and the program will terminate. And it turns out that the way Linux implements this Control C operation is by sending a signal which could run a signal handler. Now, in this case, I haven't set up any signal handlers. And the default action, if you don't have a signal handler set up for the Control C signal, is to terminate your program. But we can change that. I can edit my program to add some stuff, to set up a signal handler. And then I can make it so when I press Control C, you know, that's because I've done this setup work. When I press Control C, my program just outputs a message and moves on. It keeps taking input. And what's happening here is that the OS doesn't interpret Control C as just a get rid of the current program. It says, ask the current program what it wants to do about Control C. And if I don't say what I want to do, it assumes I want to get terminated, but I can say, tell the OS, hey, this is what I want to do when there's a Control C. So let's look at the code I need to write to tell the OS, here's what I want you to do when this Control C event happens. And here's what that code can look like. So I'm calling this system call wrapper sig action here. And that this is how I'm registering a handler. And I have the information about my handler in this act act struct that I set up in the previous lines of code. And I'm handling a specific kind of signal. And the name for the kind of signal that Control C triggers is SIGINT, for interrupt. And when I set up my act struct that I'm telling it how do I want to handle this Control C event, I gave the OS a pointer to my function, my handle SIGINT function. And I also did some other setup. So I set this empty mask. You can look up what the mask does. We'll just always leave it empty. And I also indicated that if the signal happened in the middle of some other operation, I'd like you to resume that operation when the signal handler is done. That's what SA restart says. Where an example of another operation would be like reading from the keyboard. I want you to keep reading from the keyboard when my signal handler is done. If I don't do that, the read might fail instead. So I do this setup, and after I do this, I get this behavior. When I press Control C, it runs this function here, where I'm writing to standard out. We could make the sort of system call manually. I'm just doing that here, rather than using printf. We'll talk about why next time I didn't use printf. So printing Control C and just returning, we go back to the normal program. And what's going to happen when I actually press Control C is that, you know, my program's running, it's calling fread, I press Control C, and the hardware knows that when there's keyboard input, I need the OS to run. So there was a hardware exception that ran the OS's handler for keyboard input. And the OS's handler for keyboard input said, okay, there's this Control C. I know that's a special keyboard input, and I know that's handled by using the signal mechanism. So let me look up what the signal handlers this program has set up. And in this case, it didn't find that it had nothing set up, so it said, oh, there's a handler set up for this that the program asked me to run earlier, and this is the time it wants me to run it, so let's run it right now. And since it's part of your program, that's going to run in user mode. It's going to run just like you made a function call. It's not part of the OS's code. It's your code. So we're going to switch back to your program, but we're going to arrange to call your signal handler in your program rather than continuing what you were doing previously. We're going to, add a call to the stack and change the program counter to make that happen. Then your signal handler runs and it returns, and we're going to arrange for when it returns that it's going to make a system call to clean up the signal handler and go back to where your program was before. So when the OS sets up the call, it's going to make it so you return back to run the OS again in order to go back to where the program was, which is how we kept reading input normally. Some questions about this kind of idea where the slide calls it forwarding the exception as a signal. So we have this hardware exception, and the OS kind of converts that into calling a signal handler. The hardware does nothing about these signal handlers, and that's fine because the OS handles that entire translation. Questions about this bit? Yes?
What's the purpose of the cleanup signal handler?
So, I guess probably in most cases we could do most of this work in user mode, but we still need to clean things up because we might need to save registers that we wouldn't save for a normal function call. If you look at the SIGACTION API, if you look at all the options it has, some of those options require settings to be changed in the OS when the signal handler returns. Does that answer your question? But even without that, yeah, we need to restore all the registers, even ones that aren't normally saved on a function call. And there's extra code that's not part of your function that's going to handle that. Other questions? Okay. So in my example here, I had this SIGINT, which was our control C. And you might wonder, what are the other types of signals we have? And I have a partial list here. So there's a bunch of constants in signal.h that are various types of signals. And they correspond to the many messages you may have seen. So we have sigbus is bus error, and segv is segmentation fault. And these are the signals generated for certain kinds of memory accesses that are invalid. We have SIGINT, which is what control C is. If you do a divide by zero, that turns into SIGFE. I have written on the slide that it includes integer divide by zero. That is not a typo. Yes, that doesn't make sense because it stands for floating point exception, but it includes integer divide by zero. That's just history. We have signals for what do you do if your program's you're SSH'd into portal, you're running a program and you disconnect. So the way that's handled on Linux is that we'll send a sig hang up to the program, which by default terminates the program. But if the program has something better it wants to do when you disconnect, it can have a handler for that signal and do something else rather than just being killed. We're going to have a lab that uses signals next week where we're going to want to have sort of custom signals that we just send manually with the send signal function, which is called kill. And we're going to use sig user 1 and sig user 2 for that because they're just signal numbers for whatever you want to use them for. And there's a common question of if I can catch control C, can't I make my program unkillable? And the answer is no. And the reason why is that we're going to have a signal we can send called sigkill that you can try to register a handler for, but it won't do anything. It will always terminate your program when it's sent, which means that if you've ever used the kill command, so if you do kill, if your PID is 134, if you do kill 1034, that will send sig term. But you can also do kill minus kill 34, that sends sig kill, and that, nothing the program can do, if you have permission to send that signal, will stop that program from terminating because if it handlers are ignored for sig kill. And there's a similar signal sig stop, which suspends a process, so kind of like control Z, but can't be ignored. If you know control Z, that does sig TSTP, which suspend defaults to suspending a program, but you could handle it, like control C. So we'll talk, we'll finish this up next time and talk about some of these signals which might seem a little weird to handle, what happens if you try, and more about sort of interesting things that happen when we try to use these signal mechanisms.